The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So the resolution itself doesn't sort of articulate the scope specifically, but what it signals is that Nadler, presumably with Speaker Pelosi's blessing, is gathering in from the other committees information from other investigations. And from reporting, what we know that to include almost certainly is the potentially illegal payments to Stormy Daniels and Kara McDougal prior to the election, which, of course, Michael Cohen is going to jail for in, you know, his actions in connection with those activities. And the president is individual one in those materials. The second bucket of issues it seems that they will be pulling in are other corruption-related inquiries.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 10th, 2019. Congress is back. You may have heard it. The lengthy August recess has come to a close. We have an impeachment investigation, not an inquiry, an investigation. We have an expanded scope of it. We have confrontations between the executive branch and the legislature, and all that work Congress is supposed to do isn't going away. There are budget issues. There's a National Defense Authorization Act. And Molly Reynolds and Margaret Taylor are here to discuss it all. We talked about what we should call the impeachment, whatever it is that the House Judiciary Committee is doing. We talked about who's going to be forced to testify and what courts are going to rule and when. And we talked about whether any normal congressional business will get done. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 451, Congress, Congress, and more Congress. I want to start with the question, the sort of increasingly metaphysical question of impeachment. Are we at this point dealing with a real impeachment process, and what is behind the nomenclature dispute about whether to have, you know, the speaker doesn't want an impeachment process, the House Judiciary Chairman does, and so we seem to have compromised with an impeachment process that we don't call one, only now we're suddenly have rules proposed to govern the impeachment process that we won't call an impeachment process. So Molly, get us started. What are the metaphysics of impeachment?
Sure. So I think where we are, to sort of understand that, we need to go back a little bit to earlier in the year, where Margaret and I actually spent some time thinking about this question earlier in the year. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that in the last two times that the House has considered impeaching a president, so Clinton in 98, Nixon in 1974, they began the sort of process formally with a vote of the full House on a resolution. One of the really important things in those resolutions involved what were the powers that the Judiciary Committee needed to conduct the investigative work that would go into a possible vote on articles of impeachment. And the current Congress, thanks to evolution in congressional power since the 70s, since the late 90s, the Judiciary Committee already had a lot of that power, so it didn't really need to go to the full House to get it, which was convenient for the political reasons that you outlined, because there is this disagreement between the Speaker, between Chairman Nadler and others about whether and how aggressively to pursue impeachment. And so I would argue that, you know, we've been doing things, Congress has been doing things that fall under the heading of an impeachment investigation, which is the terminology that I think Nadler has been using in recent weeks, for quite some time. We are seeing this week a little bit of an escalation of that process, with the Judiciary Committee setting out some rules, some procedures for it to use inside the committee as it continues this investigation.
Margaret, Molly and Jerry Nadler like the term impeachment investigation. Some people, including me, have made fun of the House about this because it seems to be trying to get the legal benefits of having an impeachment process, to the extent that there are such legal benefits, particularly in litigation, without actually taking responsibility for having the House pass a resolution saying, now we're contemplating the impeachment of the president. Is there a good reason to go through this weird dance of calling it an impeachment investigation and not having that resolution? Or is that really a matter of political convenience for the Democratic leadership?
So I think, you know, one of the words that we have used in the past is this impeachment inquiry. And this word inquiry specifically sort of traditionally connotes that there has been a full vote by the House of Representatives to initiate impeachment proceedings. That's what's sort of missing here. There's no specific resolution authorizing the Judiciary Committee to do the inquiry. So that's why you're not hearing the word inquiry. You're hearing these other terms, investigation, impeachment proceedings, I think is also some of the language that Chairman Nadler has used. In terms of whether it's sort of absolutely necessary or not, I mean, I actually think it's a different proceeding that we sort of backed into here, or a different situation, but I'm not sure for practical purposes it's really any different from where the Judiciary Committee was in the context of the Clinton impeachment proceedings or inquiry and the Nixon impeachment inquiry. So I think practically speaking, we've sort of landed in the same place. Why that has occurred, I think there's a number of different theories out there. As you both sort of noted, the political ramifications perhaps of having, you know, red state Democrats vote on an impeachment inquiry is maybe not having everyone feel particularly comfortable. There's also, as you know, the various litigation matters that the Judiciary Committee and other committees are pursuing, one of which is this desire to get grand jury material connected with the Mueller report. And in order for the committee to have the strongest case before the court in getting that grand jury material, because it's restricted by statute, they view themselves as sort of having to either be in a formal impeachment proceeding or doing something preliminary to a formal impeachment proceeding.
I mean, I do think when I think about it strategically from the Democrats' point of view, I do think there's a kind of unprincipled elegance to this solution, in the sense that, you know, you have people who are slamming their fists on the table and demanding a formal impeachment inquiry, by which they mean a set of hearings antecedent to impeaching the president. And you have a group of people who are saying impeachment, including the speaker, impeachment would be a bad idea. We don't want to do it. And so they don't want to formally set out on the road that will lead eventually there, because the president's conduct is so awful. And so once you say, okay, now we're going to have a formal process that evaluates this, it's pretty hard to say, nah, it's not that bad. So what they do instead is they don't formally start that process. They just act like they've always been engaged in that process. And that leaves them a little bit more room to back down later and say, hey, well, we never actually said we were pursuing impeachment. We were just kind of investigating it. Is that a happy, from Pelosi's point of view, is that a happy collateral effect of the way they've chosen to proceed, Molly? Or do you think that's actually behind the way they've chosen to proceed?
So look, I don't know what's inside the Speaker of the House's head. If I did, I would have a different job or someone would pay me more money. But I think that it's really important, again, to think about the powers that the House needs to do what it's doing. And the fact that in some ways they didn't need to take a formal vote of the full House to have the investigative authorities that they want to use here. They didn't need to take a vote of the full House for the Judiciary Committee to have really robust subpoena power. And so at the end of the day, they can afford to kind of take this this solution is a little bit of a political compromise for the different parts of the Democratic Party because they already kind of have the procedural backup to do it, is I think how I think about it.
All right. So let's turn to the substance of what this resolution says. But Margaret, let's start by just explain what this resolution is.
Sure. So what we have as of today is the draft.
And today is Monday, right, for listeners who will not be hearing this until Tuesday or later.
Right. It's a draft. And so this draft resolution won't be formal or, you know, official until it is voted on in committee, which we expect will happen on Thursday. But what we can tell from the draft, it's actually quite a simple document. It's only about 5 pages long. It has a bunch of, you know, 3 pages or so of what we call whereas clauses, which are paragraphs that sort of set out the context and the history and sort of why the committee is doing something. And then really the operative sections of the resolution, there's really just 4 pieces of it. The first is that the chairman can essentially have subcommittees do hearings that are part of this impeachment investigation. The second is that committee staff, as designated by the chair and ranking member, can question witnesses for an additional hour, equally divided between the majority and the minority, beyond the questioning that's done by the members of the committee. The third point is it specifies that, you know, information received pursuant to sort of written materials, written information or transcribed interviews, depositions, are received into the committee in something called, quote, executive session, unquote. And really what that means here for our purposes or the purpose of this resolution is that it's not public. Those are not public materials that can just be released by any of the members. They're considered sort of confidential within the committee unless the chairman and ranking agree to release it. That provision also sort of touches on the grand jury materials as well and references an earlier set of parameters that the committee had put on those potential grand jury materials. And then the fourth section is, it just outlines the president's sort of rights in this process. And it specifies that the president's counsel can respond in writing to information and testimony presented to the committee in open session. And in addition, the chairman and the ranking member can invite the president's counsel to review and respond in writing to executive session material. So in other words, the chairman, actually after consultation with the ranking member, can say to the president's counsel, you know, here's this information we received, please respond in writing to it. And I would just say on that fourth point, Molly and I were talking about this, it's interesting because those types of rights were provided to both Nixon and Clinton in the context of those impeachment proceedings. These proceedings are actually a little bit more cabined than those 2 prior instances. In the 2 prior instances, the president, I think himself, could, you know, show up at open session and just had sort of a broader sort of swath of rights. It's just interesting that they're a little bit more contained here in this draft resolution.
Molly, how do you understand these rules in relation to the committee's history, admittedly somewhat limited modern history in impeachment inquiries or investigations?
Yeah. So I think the point that Margaret just made about the due process rights of the president and the participation of the president's counsel is exactly right. I think the rules that relate to the receipt of information and the degree to which the information is considered to be have taken in quote unquote executive session bring us more or less in line with where the Clinton and Nixon impeachment inquiries were. The piece on the handling of the grand jury material in this case is a little bit different. A lot of that has to do with the context for the specific impeachment investigations that we're talking about. So as Margaret mentioned, the procedures for handling the grand jury material related to the investigation into President Trump, should the House Judiciary Committee be granted that material, were laid out by Chairman Nadler in a separate release back in July that was done in conjunction with the court filing that the Judiciary Committee made to try to get those materials. And those procedures that the Judiciary Committee would use now, should it get the material, I think really reflect the sensitive national security nature of some of that material. They're more restrictive than the ones that were used in the Clinton impeachment investigation. But again, we're talking about two very different sets of material. The content is really different. And then the last thing that I'll say on the piece that Margaret mentioned about allowing committee counsel to question witnesses, that's actually the Judiciary Committee just exercising a power that it is granted the opportunity to exercise if it wants to by the rules of the full House. And it's just choosing to do that now. It had not previously chosen to do that. But that notion that committee staff might question witnesses equally divided between the majority and the minority for up to an hour is provided for in the House rules. And this is just the Judiciary Committee saying we feel like that power might be useful going forward.
And to be clear, because that actually strikes me as hugely consequential, that means that in future investigative hearings, we should not expect the idiotic five-minute rule in which they're alternating back and forth between members and switching members each time shouldn't necessarily predominate, right?
So my expectation is that we would continue to see the members question witnesses, and your judgment on how well that goes is up to you. But this allows, in addition to that, for questioning by the staff. I think that most of what we know about members of Congress suggests that they will continue to want to play an active role in the hearings, whether they do what we might consider a good job of coordinating on what that looks like remains to be seen. But I don't, for example, think we will see open questioning of witnesses by the Judiciary Committee that has no participation by members. That would surprise me.
That would surprise me, too. I do think, though, Ben, you're right. There's a possibility if, for example, like the chief counsel for the committee, both the, you know, on the majority and minority side are asking, they can have an hour divided evenly to sort of pursue a line of questioning. So maybe they do 30 minutes for one of the counsels and 30 minutes for the other. And that would give you, I think, a more sustained understanding of the line of questioning that the counsel wants to pursue.
Right. Okay. So all of these great rules for inquiry that we're having are accompanied by an additional component, which is that the scope of the investigation seems to be increasing. When we started with this, it was principally about the findings of the Mueller report, right? But now it actually seems to be metastasizing a bit. So, Margaret, other than whether to impeach the president, what is the committee investigating? Or another way of asking that, the committee is investigating whether to impeach the president for what?
It's a great question. And I will, just with reference to this draft resolution we've been talking about, point our listeners to, there is one of these whereas clauses that references an August 22nd, 2019 letter that Chairman Nadler sent to certain of the other chairs of the committees, asking them to share information they have obtained over the course of their oversight investigations, and noted the Judiciary Committee's authority and intent to conduct an investigation to determine whether to recommend articles of impeachment. So the resolution itself doesn't sort of articulate the scope specifically, but what it signals is that Nadler, presumably with Speaker Pelosi's blessing, is gathering in from the other committees information from other investigations. And what we know that to include almost certainly is the potentially illegal payments to Stormy Daniels and Kara McDougal prior to the election, which, of course, Michael Cohen is going to jail for in, you know, his actions in connection with those activities. And the president is individual one in those materials. The second bucket of issues, it seems that they will be pulling in are other corruption-related inquiries. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the scope of that is. I mean, you know, just sort of over the past few days, we've seen a number of different things coming out on the corruption front. So, for example, Vice President Pence going to Ireland and staying in Trump's resort there, which is like on the other side of the country in Ireland. And the question of, you know, enrichment of the president's businesses. There also over the weekend was reporting about definitely questionable stays by members of the military in the resort, Trump's resort in Scotland. And that's sort of all brewing. And, you know, there's a number of different sort of pieces like that sort of hanging out there.
Right. So the this letter that Margaret is referencing that was sent by Nadler on August 22nd went to Chairman Schiff of the Intelligence Committee, Chairwoman Waters of the Financial Services Committee, Chairman Cummings of the Oversight Committee, and Chairman Engel of the Foreign Affairs Committee. So that should give us a sense of what other investigative and oversight work that the House has been doing, that the Judiciary Committee now is looking to get information about, because it might inform the impeachment investigation that they do in the coming weeks.
But one of the oddities of this is that, you know, the Karen McDougal, Stormy Daniels payments and Trump's role about them has been known literally for a year. And the corruption stuff or the emoluments stuff, if we define that as corruption, has been a feature of the Trump presidency since literally the first day of it. I mean, it was not a secret that he owned the Trump Hotel and that foreign entities were going to stay in it, right? And so it does have this weird effect of, like, the House Judiciary Committee kind of didn't seem to care very much, even under Democratic leadership, about these things until the Mueller investigation material kind of didn't gin up enough outrage to justify an impeachment. And now it's kind of expanding scope in response to that. And I'm curious, Margaret, whether your sense is that there's some reasonable justification for the expansion, i.e. somehow circumstances have changed, or number two, they haven't changed. The committee is just late, and but kind of, I guess, better late than never. They're kind of finally paying some attention to this stuff. Or number three, whether the attention that they're paying is really just that this stuff became convenient all of a sudden, whereas before it was, you know, we kind of pushed it aside because we expected the Mueller report to do the major work for us, the us here being the Democrats on the committee.
So I actually think it's not specifically any of those possibilities. I think that the initial strategy of House leadership was to have the committees, and in the beginning of the Congress, have the committees go out and start doing investigations that mattered and that were important and held promise in terms of being something that uncovers bad activity. The committees then went out and did all that stuff. And, you know, whether it was being done in quiet or in open session, I think that work has been sort of proceeding apace. And now they're being sort of more gathered up into the Judiciary Committee. I think that's particularly true on some of the corruption-related things that Chairman Elijah Cummings for House Oversight has been pursuing. On the sort of Stormy Daniels payments, I think your sort of analysis is more right on that one, because I do think the Judiciary Committee, I think you're right, they were, and this was the sort of party line from House Democrats for a long time, is like, we're waiting for the Mueller report. We're just waiting for the Mueller report. And they did. And they came in, then they did the hearing with Bob Mueller, and now it makes sense to step back and say, okay, where are we on all these things? Where are the committees on all these investigations? Which of these issues does it make sense to roll up into a broader impeachment proceeding. And I think that's what they're doing now.
Yeah, I think I generally agree with Margaret. I think it's important to remember that even in this moment where we have so much investigative work going on, that there are parts of Congress that are still, you know, fundamentally Congress, including, number one, the need to divide up the workload, that, you know, we have humans doing the actual work and they can only do so much work. And so there's an argument for dividing that up across committees. And then also the interest of individual committee chairs in protecting their own committee jurisdictions. And so to the extent that we could proceed through the first, you know, 8-9 months of the year, balancing a set of competing considerations, including a desire on the part of chairman to retain responsibility for things in their jurisdiction. I think that for me explains a lot of what we're seeing.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, there were investigations that were pursued. It seemed like, you know, they sort of threw a bunch of stuff up on the wall and some of the spaghetti stuck and some of it didn't. And so now they're seeing, okay, well, what's sort of sticking and where's some there and let's gather all that up. So there are things that, you know, seem, at least to me at this point, to have fallen by the wayside. So, for example, the Elijah Cummings's investigation into the white security clearances process, that seems to have sort of fizzled out and doesn't seem to be part of this. Maybe it gets revived later, but it's sort of something they explored, but then it's sort of not part of this.
That's interesting. I want to throw out one final element of why the Stormy Daniels thing and Karen McDougal stuff kind of revives relatively late, which is that there is an awkwardness for Democrats having basically said relatively trivial crimes committed to cover up a sexual affair are not impeachable, having made that argument sort of 20 years ago very emphatically. There's something awkward now about saying, yeah, but it's really different. And there are arguments that it's different. Some of them cut one way, some of them cut the other way. But I do think if you're Jerry Nadler or Zoe Lofgren, who were really opposed to the Clinton impeachment and said sort of lies about sex aren't enough to impeach, you really rather be in Mueller report land than in Karen McDougal land. Is that fair?
I think so. I mean, I guess I would just, you know, put in a plug for, you know, to me it's unclear, you know, did the president commit crimes in the process of trying to become president, which to me seems just like a more fundamental sort of problem in terms of the criminal law. Certainly lying under oath is also a problem.
I agree. So I think there are differences. And as I say, some of them cut one way. So that one, you know, corruption of the election process is one that is exacerbating in this regard. On the other hand, we generally don't think of pre-presidential conduct as impeachable. That cuts the other direction, right? So, but I think the fundamental thing is not the differences, it's the similarities, that these are both crimes that are, yeah, they're definitely crimes and they're committed to cover up marital indiscretions of a sort that most people don't think of themselves as disqualifying with respect to the presidency. There's also like a prudishness, I think, if Congress would rather not have hearings about sex, right?
I don't know about that.
I mean, I think the fact that we're sort of talking about this whole range of issues is just an important reminder that there are so many moving parts to this story. And that Margaret's absolutely right that for a while, particularly at the beginning of the calendar year, the messaging that was coming out of the House Democratic leadership in particular was, we're waiting for the Mueller report, we're waiting for the Mueller report. But at the same time, there was all this other stuff that was being investigated. And so it can be challenging to kind of keep all of it in your head at the same time. And so as it becomes clear that the Judiciary Committee is thinking about expanding the scope of what falls under its impeachment investigation, I think that'll be increasingly important to just remember that there are a lot of moving parts here, and that the committee, the rest of us, are going to have to figure out how to try to monitor them all at the same time.
All right. To have an impeachment investigation under any rules with any scope, you do need witnesses. And the availability of witnesses has, I think, been the House's principal problem so far. the administration has been just extremely aggressive in preventing people from showing up at all, or once they show up, limiting what they can say. There have been a whole bunch of those matters that have ended up in litigation, and there are additional confrontations that are kind of brewing or nearing the litigation stage. Took a bit of a break from this in August when the House was out of session. So, Margaret, bring us up to speed on the sort of, you know, what is where in the confrontations department over witnesses and documents?
So I'm going to let Molly share this duty with me, but I will start out with the Judiciary Committee's legal fight to force public testimony from Don McGahn. Obviously, Don McGahn, former White House counsel, he's a key source of information for the obstruction of justice part of the Mueller report. Those proceedings have been ongoing. It became clear, I think last week, that we won't really even start to see any kind of resolution to that case, even at the district court level, till at least October 31st, which feels like a long way off.
And why won't we? That's Brexit Day, by the way.
That is how the judge set up the procedure for that litigation. And as Molly well knows, you know, between October 31st and December 12th, which is when Congress is planned to sort of leave town, there are only 16 session days. And so there's just a real time squeeze on the question of Don McGahn's testimony. And I also would say what Don McGahn and the White House are asserting is this thing called absolute immunity, which is sort of this idea that the person doesn't even have to show up at all. So putting aside our traditional ideas about executive privilege and fights over, well, is the witness going to talk about that or not talk about this or that? This is like, does Don McGahn have to show up?
But if he loses that and he has to show up, he still can assert executive privilege over the substance, right? That, it doesn't mean you're going to get to question it.
Yes, that's right. And so what I see here is a litigation process that's going to eat up most of the rest of the year. And then even if you get him in front of the committee, there's still potentially lots and lots more fights to be had about what exactly he can say and what he can talk about. So that whole scene on Don McGahn is not like looking so great, in my opinion, in terms of his, you know, public testimony and sort of understanding in, you know, from Don McGahn in his words, what he knows about the obstruction of justice piece of the Mueller report. So that's one set. Another set is actually Corey Lewandowski, who was on a key figure in the campaign, actually is set to testify before Congress. And Molly, you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So before Congress went on its August recess, the House Judiciary Committee approved a set of subpoenas to about a dozen individuals. And among these were a subpoena to Lewandowski, a subpoena to Rick Dearborn, and a subpoena to Rob Porter, which carried a request for an appearance at a hearing on September 17th. Reporting over the weekend, at least, suggests that Lewandowski may be planning to appear for that hearing. It's less clear about the other two. That, for me, is the sort of next biggest coming fight over witness testimony. There's also, Ben, you asked specifically about witnesses. There's a separate set of legal fights going on about documents and that various House committees would like to get their hands on. There are two separate cases that are proceeding around Trump's financial records, one of which involves a suit involving the House Oversight Committee and Mazars, which is an accounting firm. The other one involves Trump Organization financial records held by Capital One and Deutsche Bank. That case involves the House Intelligence and Financial Services Committees. Margaret's already mentioned the legal proceedings around access to the Mueller grand jury materials that involve the House Judiciary Committee. And then the last thing I'd put on the table is the ongoing lawsuit by the House Ways and Means Committee, where they're attempting to get Trump's tax returns. So it's some of this is about witnesses, and you're right that to have hearings, we need witnesses. But there's also a lot of legal action on the sort of document front and where House committees are trying to get information.
And I would just note on the House Ways and Means Committee's attempts to get Trump's tax returns from Treasury and the IRS, there was a setback, I think, for House Democrats. The judge essentially, you know, decided that he was not going to make a summary judgment decision and put the case on sort of a normal track, which contrasts with, in terms of time, that contrasts with how the judges in the Mazars case and the Deutsche Bank case sort of expedited things at the district court level. The judge in that the tax returns case is not doing that. And so that, again, I think is kind of a question mark. And it was interesting in the decision that the judge issued, he specifically says, you know, this case could look a lot different if the decisions in the Mazars and the Deutsche Bank case get decided. So it's almost like he seemed to signal he was going to sort of wait and see and hold back on that before moving forward in a sort of expeditious way on the tax returns issue.
And just so that we understand the scope of what's at stake here, what are the issues in the Mazars and Deutsche Bank case? And given that the judges have seemed to expedite consideration, when do we expect a disposition?
So the district court judges in both the Mazars and the Deutsche Bank case, they made their decisions pretty quickly. Now the question of what the circuit courts will do
are the D.C. and Second Circuits, right?
Right. The D.C. Circuit is the Mazars case. The Second Circuit is the Deutsche Bank case. Oral arguments have been completed in both of those circuits for those cases. So now we're waiting for the actual opinions to come out from those three-judge panels deciding whether to uphold the respective district court decisions. I don't have a good bead on when exactly those opinions will pop out. Even after they do, there will be this question of whether either or both are taken up by the Supreme Court.
And one thing I would say is that to go back to something we were talking about earlier about this notion of the Judiciary Committee trying to sort of get more information under its purview, the Judiciary Committee is actually not the committee that's involved in either of these cases. It's the Oversight Committee in the Mazars case and the Intelligence and Financial Services Committees in the Deutsche Bank case. And so I think that as we anticipate rulings in those cases, if they are favorable to the House, another way we can read this decision by the Judiciary Committee to try to expand the scope of its impeachment investigation a bit is because it may want to explore the topics that are coming out of those court cases if they're done favorably to the House.
Right. And just to answer your question directly, Ben, about sort of the issues.
Yeah. What's at stake here?
Right. So in those cases, the House has argued that needs access to these materials. The Trump counsel, which is Trump's actually doing this in his personal capacity in the Mazars and Deutsche Bank case, the counsel for Trump have said, no, there's no valid legislative purpose here. And so the committee is not entitled to these documents. The question in my mind is, if we're now in a more formal-ish impeachment proceeding, you know, how does a court, you know, consider that? Do House Democrats, if there's other, you know, opportunities for proceedings, do they go in and say, hey, you know, that whole legislative purpose argument is out the door because now this is all, you know, circled up within our impeachment proceedings?
Boy, I would hate for them to win on that basis because, you know, first of all, it's not, as Molly points out, neither of these are subpoenas from the House Judiciary Committee sitting in any kind of impeachment capacity. They are subpoenas from other committees in a routine oversight capacity. And the president's rather extravagant position is that he as a third party gets to intervene to prevent the subpoena to a willing recipient who's willing to provide the information because he doesn't think there's a valid legislative purpose and he doesn't like the political implications. And it seems to me that to say, well, he loses because there's an impeachment inquiry pending is kind of an inadequate response to that. I would hope that particularly the D.C. Circuit would deal very firmly with that as John Roberts would say, calling balls and strikes in an interbranch conflict.
And I do have a question mark in my mind of whether it made sense for the House to go ahead and pursue those litigation in order to sort of nail down that investigative power and its broad scope before kind of moving to the impeachment piece.
So let's turn now to, you know, Congress is back and it's not like all of this stuff, which we've just spent you know, almost an hour talking about is Congress's regular day job. You know, there's this other stuff that they do, legislation and appropriations. They don't do a lot of either of them. But Molly, if they don't do any of it, then the government doesn't continue to function. So where are we in the long-term standoff between border wall funding and everything else that Congress may want to do that the government requires it to do?
Sure. So let me provide a little bit of context here. So the new federal fiscal year begins on October 1st. The current spending bills funding discretionary federal programs run out at the end of September. So Congress needs to take some action over the next several weeks to make sure that the government does not shut down. In the background of all of this is a deal that Congress and the White House reached in late July that did two things. Importantly, it resolved the issue of the debt limit through the middle of 2021. So we don't have to worry about playing chicken with the full faith and credit of the United States for another almost 2 years. And then it also, that agreement also established new top line spending numbers. So it set the overall size of the federal pie for both defense programs and non-defense programs. Now what Congress needs to do is fill in all of those details about how that money is actually going to be allocated. The House made a fair amount of progress on its spending bills, its version of the spending bills, before leaving on its summer recess. The Senate did none of that work, and so is now kind of in a sprint over the next couple of weeks to get some of that done. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Richard Shelby has indicated that he would like to try and get several of those individual spending bills done in the next couple of weeks, particularly the ones for the Defense Department and the bill that funds the Departments of Labor, Health and Human Services, and Education. Together, those make up about two-thirds of the federal discretionary budget, so it's a lot of money. And so actually getting that done, however, is going to require both sort of sustained effort on the part of Congress and resolving some of these conflicts about individual spending items. Those conflicts, frankly, are going to be present in conjunction with a temporary spending bill as well. The White House has indicated, has released its list of sort of additional legislative language that it would like to see in a temporary spending bill. And several of those provisions are potentially controversial, including things around, as you mentioned, the border wall. And this sort of, I think, this conflict ratcheted up a notch or two when the Trump administration released its list of military construction projects that were potentially going to go unfunded so that the administration could transfer money that was going to go to those projects in order to redirect it to the border. So things like a new middle school on a military base in Kentucky, which I will also remind you is the home of the Senate Majority Leader. And so I think we're going to see a fair amount of this conflict play out over initially the next couple of weeks and then also over the next couple of months. And so my sense is that there is very little appetite on Capitol Hill for another actual shutdown, that, like the one that we saw at the end of last year and the beginning of this year. But that doesn't mean that the process of avoiding a shutdown isn't going to be ugly.
Somehow I think that middle school in Kentucky is going to be just fine. Bottom line, between actual shutdown and process is going to be ugly is a lot of space. Is the bottom line going to be that we're going to spend a lot of time this fall talking about budget brinksmanship and the possibility of a shutdown? Or is this going to be a situation like the debt ceiling where, you know, people get out a few weeks or months ahead of the problem and say, let's not have this fight. Let's have, you know, a clean presidential election without this as a kind of hanging over it overlay to it?
So I think it's probably a little closer to the second than to the first, again, because I think folks were a little bit spooked by how badly things went off the rails at the end of last year. But I have been wrong about these things in the past. And I do think that by and large, the conflicts are likely to be concentrated as opposed to sort of diffuse across across these issues. It helps that in the deal that they reached at the end of July, there is more money available on both the non-defense side and the defense side of the budget. And so, you know, it's easier to make everyone happy when you have more money to spread around. But we'll see.
Margaret, in the entire post-war history of the Congress of the United States, one piece of significant lawfare-related work has always happened, and Congress has never failed to pass a National Defense Authorization Act, no matter how dysfunctional things have gotten. So here's my question. Is this the year we are finally going to break the record and fail to pass an NDAA?
I don't think so. I think this is going to get done. That said, you know, depending on what happens with the impeachment stuff, if that gets super rancorous, depending on what happens and how the border wall issues get sorted out, we don't yet really know how Senate Republicans are going to kind of play that border wall issue. So with that caveat, my sense is that all the players are pretty committed to getting the NDAA done. The outside conferees, meaning the people who can participate in the conference between the House and the Senate, but are not on Senate Armed Services or House Armed Services, they were all told to complete their work as of last Friday. This month, the month of September, I think will be taken up with the conference, so reconciling.
So both houses have bills,
yes,
that are passed, and they are in the process of reconciling. How different are they?
So that is the million-dollar question. There's a lot that's shared in there and will be perfectly fine. There are, however, a pretty long list of issues that will be controversial and are different between the House and the Senate version. So just to give you a very short list, I'm not going to go on forever. There are a bunch of wall-related, border wall-related provisions. In the House bill, there's a prohibition on the use of force against Iran. There's language also in the House bill repealing the 2002 Iraq AUMF, which as a general matter, Democrats sort of support, but the administration will almost certainly oppose for various reasons. There's a bunch of provisions related to Guantanamo and could have the potential to sort of change the status quo on Guantanamo. There's a disagreement on whether to block the deployment of low-yield nuclear weapons on submarines, which is controversial and very important. There's a whole North Korea sanctions bill. There's a whole Burma sanctions bill. There are a bunch of climate-related provisions. So just tons of things in there that, you know, the conferees are going to have to work out. And as I look at them, it's just not clear to me what the middle path is on a lot of those things.
It sounds like we need an NDAA wonk out podcast all of its
definitely
own. So let's
definitely
we will bring that to you as the conference committee proceeds with its work.
I do think though that this will get done. I suspect it will get done sort of in October, November timeframe.
Yeah, I think one thing that is will be important to watch, frankly, both on the resolution of the appropriations process and on the NDAA, is the degree to which increasingly in recent years these large bills, large omnibus spending bills, the NDAA, have become the target for moving other pieces of legislation because they are seen as must-pass. So Margaret mentioned two different sanctions bills that are in the NDAA. And this is, you know, in the contemporary Congress, this is something we see a lot of. So for folks out there who have interests in these areas, that's something to watch out for, that when we talk about the NDAA, when we talk about the omnibus, it's often not just, you know, individual spending provisions, individual defense authorization provisions. It's what other major policy priorities hitch a ride.
And on that, in that vein, I would just also note that the Intelligence Authorization Act is hitching a ride on the NDAA as well. That is an authorization bill that hasn't basically been done in 3 years. I think it is going to get done this year. There's a bunch of really important and interesting things in there. One I would just note is a provision which there seems to be agreement on, which is 12 additional weeks of paid leave for intelligence community employees. So that is something I'm watching with interest.
Well, any intelligence community employees who want to take their additional 12 weeks of leave and come hang out at Lawfare and do podcasts and talk about Congress are more than welcome. Margaret Taylor, Molly Reynolds, thanks for joining us.
Thanks,
Ben. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. This week is a good example of why. Two of my Brookings colleagues are here talking about Congress. That's kind of Brookings Lawfare cooperation right there. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, to buy lots of Lawfare merch. You need to rate us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on PodTrack, whatever you use. And you need to share us on social media. I want you to tweet about this episode of the Lawfare podcast. And I want you to listen to every piece of music that Sophia Yan, who is playing the music to take us out of this episode, has ever recorded. Because Sophia Yan has been playing the Lawfare podcast music since the beginning of the Lawfare podcast. This episode was recorded by Michaela Fogel. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.